So I am especially pleased to welcome an affiliate Gen Z, which brings me back to my earlier very happy years in Vienna. So she has been a researcher and a teacher at the Austrian Academy of Sciences, also at the University of Vienna. And she's now a professor for Indian art history at Naples University, L'Orientale. And she's a very, very, probably one of the very best specialists of Gandharan art, and especially of the Swat Valley, in which she has been conducting much archaeological and art historical research.
Thank you, Vincent. I hope to match your presentation. So thanks, thanks to the organizers and for combining such a nice group of specialists. So it's a well-known fact that for centuries the spread of Buddhism across Asia stimulated the important phenomena of transmission and adaptation of artistic forms. However, the materiality of this phenomena, which is substantially entangled with the mobility of artworks and art makers, is still largely underexplored and not satisfactorily understood. Moreover, although Buddhism represented in ancient world a form of organizational culture, we must not forget that unitary and pluralistic manifestations coexisted and reflected the different ways in which different collectivities gave meaning and content to the same notions or objects. Besides, as we will discuss later, physical mobility and transmission cannot be captured by simple models of gradual diffusion across contact zones or across time, since long-distance contacts and anachronisms played a non-trivial role in the process. The exemplification I choose span over a large area, stretching across modern-day Pakistan, Afghanistan, and Xinjiang, and a period roughly corresponding to the second half of the first millennium CE. This fragmented patchwork doesn't coherently link the different contexts with each other, nor pretends to be systematic. My personal limits and the partiality and inadequacy of the available archaeological records restrict the ambition of my presentation to a glimpse of different modes of circulation and adaptation of artistic forms. By and large, we can identify three main patterns of uniformity: sameness, similarity, and imitation. Before delving into such matters, I would like to spend some words about the theoretical framework guiding this empirical inquiry. The praise of originality and the detraction of copying pertain to a modernist value system. Conversely, these are questionable assumptions when applied to ancient visual art, in which the act of copying, hardly ever exactly indeed, is often a means of partaking of the intrinsic value of an original held as authoritative. Besides serving basic needs for models, the programmatic use of free copies of recognizable prototypes was part of what we can call aesthetics of sameness, which was instrumental to the construction of cultural identities. Let's start from the impact of stone Gandharan art on neighbor regions in the first century CE. Centuries. It is a significant fact that notwithstanding the Afghan and Central Asian Buddhist artistic production was mainly based on clay, several sites have yielded stone reliefs and statues. As for Afghanistan, mention can be made of Hadda, Khoja Safa, Karacha, Shotorak, Paitava, Koimori, and more recently Messainak in the Logar province. With the exception of the Capisce province, where a local production is unmistakably recognizable on account of distinctive stylistic and iconographic features, and possibly Hadda, where the large quantity and general morphological unity suggests the existence of local workshops, a doubt remains in many cases as to the original source. In particular, some specimens found at Shotorak and Karacha, showing a mastered Buddha with a tall Ushnisha tied at the base by a string or ring, decidedly point to a provenance from Swat, the celebrated Udiana, which largely owed its fame to the wealth and prestige of its Buddhist monuments. What is more, on the basis of their stylistic features, these reliefs are to be ascribed to the earliest phase of Gandharan art, which is safely attributed in Swat to a period not later than the first century CE. Whether these early pieces of Gandharan art were simply treasured as venerable relics or used as actual models, it is impossible to say. But in either case, I think they could have been part of a ritualized process of establishment of new sacred places through imitation, or even through a kind of metaphorical insemination of the new sacred places with the seeds of a time-honored tradition. That relatively small sculptures could serve as models for sculptures of bigger size is a well-attested practice within single sites, as for instance at Putkara I in Swat. But the same scheme could also circulate and be reproduced across distant sites, as witnessed by the evidence collected by our colleague Pierre Cambon. However, the most astonishing case of long-distance circulation of models is represented by the mural paintings from Miran. These paintings, which cannot be dated earlier than the 4th century CE or even later, clearly show the derivation from the early production of Swat, and namely the one which has its best expression in the frieze of the main stupa of Saidu Sharif I. The stupa and its frieze, and obviously the wool of the related stylistic group, are dated to around the mid-first century CE. The frieze, still belonging to the earliest production, the so-called drawing style, is nonetheless at the threshold of that naturalistic style, which will definitely supersede the previous one and is almost unanimously considered to represent the highest standard of Gandharan art. Thus, we can say that the one in Miran is a deliberate anachronism, probably meant to reenact an idealized place as Swat or ancient Udiana must have been perceived by the Buddhist Ecumene. Below it lays a still largely unknown history of close contacts and intentional imitaciones. A bronze Buddha head, whose source, either physical or just ideal, is once again Swat, was found in Khotan. Additionally, the recent discovery of Gandhari texts from the Swat's neighbor regions provides evidence that the Khotan Dhammapada, for instance, is not an isolated anomaly, but may be the eastern outpost of a prestigious and early literary tradition originating in those areas, Swat and adjoining regions. Be that as it may, the case of Miran opens a question about the source of similarities in designs and contents in sites widely separated in distance and time. Besides visual memory and movable artworks, we cannot exclude the existence of sketchbooks, not only passed down in family teams or workshops, but also realized as mnemonic copies of famous monuments in a way and with aims not dissimilar from copying written texts. Also, molds must have played a significant role in the spread of uniform visual imagery, especially in the region under scrutiny, where clay was the main medium of sculpture and architectural decoration. Again, the main issue regards the art-making system and the internal organization of the workshops moving in the circuit of Buddhist establishments. It is difficult to say whether workshops produced on their own the patricks from which molds were made, or whether patricks and molds were produced and supplied by specialized choroplasts. Useless to say, all speculation about the circulation of artistic models and the mobilization of artisans largely depends on this question. Unfortunately, the limited evidence available is ambiguous and susceptible of two different interpretations. Leaving aside the intrinsically more conservative iconographic types, such as the Buddha figure, interesting observation can be drawn from the images of donors. Besides the limited range of variations in the attire of the figures, the very act of donation, at least for a certain period of time, let's say approximately 4th to 5th century, is always expressed in a formulaic way by a coiled garland of flowers held to the chest with both hands. The repeated occurrence of this scheme in various sites bespeaks the existence of repertoires of fixed patterns and of generations of molds derived from standard patrixes. Although this specific imagery cannot be used for establishing a safe chronology, it may nonetheless provide some clues about relative chronology, since it seems to be replaced later by the equally formulaic image of kneeling couples displaying strong hunnic connotations. A different case is represented by the simultaneous presence in different sites of exactly the same types obtained by exactly the same molds. Such is the case with sculptures found at Messeinak and at Karwar, two sites lying in the Logar province in Afghanistan at about 50 kilometers from each other. These sculptures well illustrate how seriality in mass production was avoided or attenuated by adding different details or changing the expressiveness and the physiognomic features of the face by means of chisel strokes, but the molds are basically the same. Molds were also largely used for decorative details in both figural sculpture and architecture in a rich variety of forms. I would like to illustrate one motif in particular, the apotropaic mask, which provides stimulating insights into the circular flow of motifs of Western origin, probably the best known and paradoxically less critically examined evidence of contextualized use and reuse and change of imported visual forms. A variety of mask types to which ancient mythology ascribes a prophylactic gaze widely circulated across different regions of Asia. Among them, we find the Gorgoneion, not only in its grimacing appearance, but also in its solar and regenerative significance. For instance, this Gorgoneion from the Buddhist site of Hundukistan, which is safely dated to end of 7th or early 8th century CE, which displays a solar aspect and these gorgeous vegetal branches from which form a scroll. I don't know if you can see it, the scroll emerging from the moth of the Gorgoneion, is indeed quite reminiscent of the same use in Roman sarcophagi, late Roman sarcophagi, as a symbol of life, victory over death, and renewal of life. This interpretation of the motif seems to be a conscious, in Fundukistan, seems to be a conscious adaptation, especially if we consider the special funerary context of this site, which contains in one of the niches, in the same setting and with the same hierarchic scale as Buddha and Bodhisattva figures, the sculpted images and the ashes of a princely couple. The Gorgoneion from Fundukistan seems to be morphologically and semantically in line with the image of the green man, which developed in late antique, early medieval Europe, probably from the benign Gorgoneion, a circumstance which should warn us against the static notion of Western motifs transmitted to Asia once and forever, and rather make us think in terms of dynamic flows, which also invest these Western motifs. Even more interesting, for its being probably less known in Asia, is the Okeanos mask, recognizable from the crab pincers on the forehead. Several specimens of this type were unearthed at Tapasardar. They will all come, another Buddhist site. They all come from a filling layer, largely composed of fragments of sculptures from the early period of the site, which was brought to an end by a fire at some point in time, not before the 5th century CE, and not after the second half of the 7th century CE, when the sanctuary was rebuilt. So this Oceanos plaque belongs to this period. The Oceanos plaques were all produced from the same mold and used as part of personal ornaments. Traces of gilding on some of them give an idea of their original effulgence. As shown by two specimens from Tapasardar, the plaque could be applied either to headdresses or armlets. Especially the latter instance deserves attention insofar as it reveals much of the process of reception and the reuse of the motif. In both the Greek and the Roman world, Oceanos personified a primordial force, the endless stream which encircled the inhabited earth, the source and condition for existence. His cosmogonic nature encompasses the rising and setting of the stars, which set forth from his realm and return to him at the end of their path. So Oceanos marks not only the boundaries of the earth, but also the transition line between earth and heaven, and ultimately between existence and non-existence. The concept of an endless source of life running in circle, originating from itself and incessantly returning to itself, which makes of the symbol an appropriate attribute of Buddhist divine figures, is felicitously captured in the very shape of the armlet, a circular ring ending in an aquatic monster head. Such a sophisticated example of the adoption and adaptation of an alien motif is not confined to Tapasardar. Once again, exactly the same object obtained from exactly the same mold was brought to light at Messenach in a quite distant site, and once again one wonders about the underlying mechanism of diffusion. Were these molds exclusively produced and used by specific workshops, or were they made available to different workshops operating in different areas by specialized centers of production? While the second hypothesis may explain interregional affinities with an easy mobility of objects, the first one implies a more complex network created by the mobility of workshops. The presence at Messenach of an unusual installation, a colossal image of Durga Mahisha Mardini, now lost, previously only known from Tapasardar. This is the Tapasardar specimen reconstructed by fragments. And at Messenach of fragments of decoration in the same chapel at Messenach, of fragments of sculpted decoration absolutely identical in form and structure to those unearthed at Tapasardar, point, at least for this specific case, to the mobility of a workshop rather than to a simple sharing of models and models. We may perhaps conclude that both patterns of mobility, objects and craftsmen, were deeply woven into the texture of trans-regional artistic conventions. Now, even at the risk of banalizing an extremely complex issue, I would like to stress the significant waves of artistic innovations, undoubtedly subsuming strong ideological pushes, that at times swept through the Buddhist ecumene. I will concentrate on a period roughly comprised between the 5th and the 6th century CE, which corresponds to an interlude of extraordinary creative endeavor. I will, thanks also to the freedom granted to the architects and choroplasts by light materials and small-scale projects, new stupa shapes and new layouts were invented. Although, again, precise dating is impossible, we can nonetheless identify non-accidental coincidences between different sites across Afghanistan and Xinjiang. As for the small stupas, some shapes seem to have remained confined to a pure experimental sphere. Others, instead, were either inspired by or lend inspiration to large-scale prototypes. Such is the case at Tapa Sardar of the star-shaped stupa, of which we know monumental specimens scattered over a vast area, from Taxila in Pakistan to Ajina Tepa in Tajikistan to Rawak in Xinjiang. Also noteworthy is the introduction of the octagonal drum in the stupa body, again attested at Tapa Sardar, but also attested at Hadda, at Lulan and Tumshuktag in Xinjiang, or the lotus-shaped ring in this stupa from Messainak, and I think also the one which has been just mentioned by our colleague Tigran for Kara Tepe, which seems to anticipate the stupa of the hipped lotuses we know from the Tibetan tradition. Viewed from a general perspective, one cannot but acknowledge the contribution of this creative season to later developments and standardizations, as for instance the conventional list, the Tibetan list of the eight stupas. I would also mention the square cella with four big figures at the corner of the room and a central cultic object, which evidently translates mandalic concepts into a three-dimensional space. And quite rare in Afghanistan, indeed, this layout and to some extent the same tendency to explore new symbolic geometries appears in Xinjiang and, for instance, at Endere and also at Dandan Ulyuk. I hope that the examples perfunctorily listed here could at least pinpoint the astonishing capacity of the diverse artistic districts of the Buddhist ecumene to move in unison with each other, though maintaining their individual characters, and to promote fecund circular exchanges. A telling case in point is the layout of the upper terrace of Tapa Sardar, which, as mentioned before, was reconstructed in the 7th early 8th century after a fire. We do not know how the original layout could look like, but the new one certainly is a very interesting case of an open-air building imitating rock architecture. The similarities with the Kizil caves can hardly be regarded as unpremeditated. Rather, I think they offered us a key to understanding the symbolic meaning of the sacred area of Tapa Sardar, which is not, or not simply, as it has often been said, a fortified monastery, but the architectural transposition of the mountain, which in turn bears witness to the prestige achieved by the architecture hewn from the mountain's rocky womb, which must have been regarded as a most felicitous metaphor of pristine condition, also thanks to the great realization we have in the Xinjiang area. I would like to close this hasty survey with a small note on a small character, the Putto, and the transformation of its image during the travel from west to east and from east to west. In general, the image of the infant or young boy we find in early Buddhist art is just that of a diminutive adult, awkwardly adapted in most cases to the model of the Western Putto. But interestingly, in late Roman art, the image of the Putto loses the chubby and graceful aspect of a child and changes into a small adult, stout and heavy. Seemingly, the Gandharan infant and the late Roman infant have in common an area of cultural intersection, namely the Roman provinces of Asia Minor. Going back to East, one can observe that the Gandharan Putto and the derived prototypes is never hairless. On the contrary, he generally shows a voluminous mass of hair, sometimes with a bundle of hair tied in a knot, or in alternative, shaved head with one or more locks of hair spared. And this is this latter prototype is a model of the infant figure, which enjoys the best success across Indian and Central Asian territories up to China, where the last and most felicitous transposition took place. also in China, prior to the development of a Buddhist artistic language, the image of the child was basically that of a small adult, which evidently was felt not adequate to embody one of the most touching Chinese visual invention, the soul newly born into paradise, which is represented by naked children resting on lotus calices. Thus, we may say that the Buddha of Gandharan ascendance has finally become a tender child who will permanently enter Chinese visual imagery as the auspicious symbol of a son's birth, and thus also spilling out of the pure Buddhist context. So I hope the child at the end expresses a hope, the hope that we really can start working somehow in closer collaboration in order to explore this interesting but so complicated network of exchanges, transmissions, adaptations, and rebouncing also of visual imagery across such a vast area. Thank you.